The original broadcast of the For the Record program number 46, based on William Pepper's book Orders to Kill, was recorded in the fall of 1995. That is roughly 10 years, a little more than 10 years, after AFA program number 8 was recorded on the 17th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination, that being April 4th of 1985. In 2016, Dr. William Pepper published the third of his books about the assassination of Martin Luther King. That is titled The Plot to Kill King, subtitled The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr. It was published in softcover by Skyhorse Publishing and copyrighted 2016 by William Pepper. And there is information in here that supplements a number of things that were spoken about in For the Record 46. I'm going to begin, but with some information about the special forces operatives who comprised a backup sniper team, if the civilian sniper team involving elements of organized crime failed in their mission. They did not. I would note that this book and this investigation by Dr. William Pepper entailed a tremendous amount of courage on his part, on the part of a Memphis Press Scimitar journalist named Steve Tompkins, and also a fellow named Jack Terrell, or Terrell, T-E-R-R-E-L-L. He was a former covert operative who helped to blow the whistle on some of the misdeeds of Oliver North and Company during the Iran-Contra scandal. Terrell had been best friends with one of the operatives named J.D. Hill, who died under very strange circumstances. He was shot dead in January of 1979 with five closely placed shots from a Magnum 357 revolver, supposedly fired by his wife. His wife was never charged in the killing, and not only Terrell but others seriously doubted that his wife, that is to say the late J.D. Hill's wife, could have handled such a powerful handgun with that degree of precision. This is against the background of many of these special forces operatives having decamped to Mexico and Latin America because they learned of what they believed was a cleanup operation underway. Some of the members of this operational backup special forces team that I spoke about in For the Record 46 and that William Pepper wrote about in Orders to Kill and supplements in The Plot to Kill King, they learned of the apparent assassinations of some of their team members, and they decided to basically decamp again to Mexico and Latin America. There were a number of other suspicious deaths as well. I would note that all of the special forces operatives that were still alive are referred to by pseudonyms, and that applies not only to the man whom Pepper calls Warren, but also two psychological operations special forces operatives who were a photograph and were basically involved with photographing the assassination scene. They ultimately did take a picture of the assassination and saw a man who appeared to be the sniper not only lowering his rifle but walking out from his perch, and that man was not, according to these people, James Earl Ray, the convicted assassin of Martin Luther King. Reading from the book The Plot to Kill King by Dr. William Pepper, and again, Warren, Reynolds, and Norton are pseudonyms here. The members of the force the special forces group that was still alive, are referred to by pseudonyms. A couple of other elements. Downey, Colonel Downey is Colonel John Downey, who was the head of the 902nd Military Intelligence Group, a highly secretive and altogether lethal military intelligence group in the U.S. Warren had refused to talk about the 902 or the 90 Deuce, as he called it, and he told William Pepper that anyone interested in the 90 Deuce should dig a deep hole. Again, the lethality of this situation and the tremendous courage showed by not only William Pepper, but also Steve Tompkins and Jack Terrell and the unnamed special forces operatives who came forward to disclose their role in history at the distance of some years. Well, this is a very brave, they manifested tremendous bravery in bringing this story to light. Now, of the photographing of the actual assassination of Martin Luther King by members of the Special Forces backup team, the Alpha 184 backup team that would have slain not only Dr. King, but also Andrew Young, had the civilian assassin failed. Obviously, he did not. Dr. Pepper writes, Warren, whom I had come to believe was credible and reliable, also said that a photograph of the actual shooting from the brush area existed, and sometime after the event, he had seen it. Warren provided the name and address of the now-retired officer who supposedly had a copy of the photo and agreed to approach him. The former PsyOps officer, whom I call Reynolds, unquote, agreed to have contact, but initially he insisted on the same procedure that had been used with his Latin American buddies. My questions would be carried to him by Steve Tompkins. That's T-O-M-P-K-I-N-S. The meeting was set for early December of 1994 in the coffee shop of the Hyatt Regency Hotel in Chicago. Reynolds was about 5 feet 10 inches tall, 160 to 170 pounds, with gray, short cropped hair. He said that in Vietnam, he had been assigned to the 1st Special Operations Group based in Can Tho, that's capital C-A-N, and capital T-H-O, two words, and that he worked for the 525th Psychological Operations Battalion. Reynolds said that he and his partner, whom I will call, quote, Norton, unquote, N-O-R-T-O-N, were deployed to Memphis on April 3, 1968, as part of a wider mission they believed was under the overall command of Colonel John Downey of the 902nd Military Intelligence Group, for whom he had worked on a number of assignments. They carried the necessary camera equipment and were armed with standard-issue 45 caliber automatics. Norton also carried a small revolver in a holster in the small of his back. They were ordered to be in position on April 4th, and on that day they arrived before noon and went directly to fire station number 2, where the captain, Cartel, C-A-R-T-H-E-L, Whedon, capital W-E-E-D-E-N, gave them access to the flat roof. They took up their positions on the east side of the roof. From that vantage point, they overlooked the Lorraine Motel and picked up any individuals in photos who might be identified as a communist or national security threat. They had an unobstructed view of the balcony in front of Dr. King's room, 306. My colleagues and I long wondered why the Army would want to take photographs of the events unfolding on that day. I have come to believe that the main reason for the photographing was likely to enable Colonel Downey and the relevant Army counterintelligence officers not only to be able to identify everyone in the vicinity of the crime scene, but also in particular to have a clear picture of what they were doing immediately before, at the time of, and immediately after the assassination. This photographic intelligence would certainly give them a head start in being able to take whatever steps were necessary to suppress observations that could potentially jeopardize the operation. and then later. More about the photograph is related here. And after discussing the photograph and both Reynolds and Warren stated that it was not James Earl Ray who was the sniper, a correction is discussed here. Again, the book Orders to Kill was published in 1995. I recorded For the Record 46, which you have just heard, in the fall, actually in November of 1995. And after that, some information came to light. In particular, in February of 1997, ABC News did a Turning Point program in which they were able to produce Colonel Eidson. That's Colonel Billy Eidson, E-I-D-S-O-N. And not Colonel Eidson, but General Henry Cobb, who had commanded the 20th Special Forces Group. The information originally given to William Pepper was that Cobb had passed away, but actually he was still alive and was actually introduced on the program, which I saw at the time. And it produced some embarrassment for Dr. William Pepper. Of the photograph and the contention by both Warren and Reynolds, again, pseudonyms, that the actual shooter was not James Earl Ray, and of the subsequent information that was developed on the ABC News Turning Point program in February of 1997, we read as follows from The Plot to Kill King. On January 27, 1996, Warren confirmed that his target, Andrew Young, was in the Lorraine parking lot at the moment Dr. King was shot. On August 17th of that year, Warren turned over the remaining 20th Special Forces Group rosters that he had. One name leapt from the Mississippi list. It was the man who Jack Terrell, best friend of Alpha 184 team member J.D. Hill, shot dead in 1979, had said was the briefing officer for the Memphis mission attached to the Mississippi contingent. Terrell had said no one was quite certain exactly who he worked for. When I obtained a photograph of Raoul, or parenthetically Raoul, was a mysterious handler of James Earl Ray. Ray claimed that his various travels and obtaining weapons were at the behest of an individual named Raoul, and that is the Raoul referred to here. He appears to have been involved in a combined military and New Orleans mafia gun-running ring that was overseen by Carlos Marcello, the capo mafioso for New Orleans, and marketed weapons obtained by these special forces operatives and sold them in Latin America. That provided capital both for the Marcello organization and also for various black operations or covert operations for the special forces that were involved with this. Raoul, William Pepper writes, when I obtained the photograph of Raoul included in the spread of six, I asked Steve to make a trip and show it to Warren. Warren instantly picked him out. He identified him as the person he had seen with Marcello's man, Zip, capital Z-I-P, Cimento, capital C-H-I-M-E-N-T-O, when they were picking up guns delivered from Camp Selby in Mississippi to New Orleans. Warren said Raoul went by the name James R. Richmond and always insisted on using the initial R. This clearly placed Raoul in the frame of the gun-running operations conducted by the Army and the Marcello organization. At 6:01 p.m. on April 4, 1968, the fatal moment when the shot rang out, Reynolds quickly snapped four or five photos following Dr. King as he fell to the balcony floor. Reynolds said Norton almost instinctively swung his camera from the parking lot to the left and, focusing on the brush area, caught the assassin, a white man, on film as he was lowering his rifle. He then took several shots of him as he was leaving the scene. Reynolds said that though Norton had caught the assassin clearly in his camera, He personally only saw the back of the shooter as he left the scene. They hand-delivered the pictures to Colonel Downey, but Norton kept the negatives and made another set of prints seen by both Reynolds and Warren. They both, that is to say Reynolds and Warren, categorically state that the sniper in the photograph was not James Earl Ray. In February of 1997, ABC News' Turning Point program decided to do a documentary on the King assassination. It planned to focus on the King family, my investigation and quest for a trial for James Earl Ray, and James Earl Ray's terminal illness. From the outset, we all cooperated. I persuaded Perel to be interviewed. In the hour interview, he told them what he had learned from his best friend, J.B. Hill, and about the presence of the Alpha 184 team in Memphis on April 4, 1968, and their mission. I had been informed that the leader of the eight-man team was dead. With the cooperation of the Army, however, ABC News located him alive and living in Costa Rica. With no prior notice, they brought him, along with General Henry Cobb, who commanded the 20th Special Forces Group, into an interview with me. I was surprised and told them I had obviously been given wrong information about the team leader's death. Again, that was Colonel Eidson, Billy Eidson. The overall commander was General Henry Cobb. Continuing, General Cobb and the team leader denied not only that the Alpha 184 was in Memphis, but that it even existed in 1968. They insisted that the Alabama contingent of the 20th Special Forces Group never trained at Camp Shelby, Mississippi, and was never in the city of Memphis at all. Cobb insisted that the unit could not have been involved in such an operation without his knowledge. I asked a Birmingham private investigator to check out certain details about the team leader's activities in the city and provided him with a copy of his criminal record. He had a conviction for negligent homicide and served 1 year in prison in Alabama before leaving for Costa Rica. Turning Point did not reveal this to viewers. During the course of the program, the idea that the Alpha 184 team was in Memphis to control riots was advanced. This explanation had eventually been raised by Warren in his sessions with Steve Tompkins, who came to believe it. Though I gradually came to have a different view, it made no sense to me in the context of events at the time. This was before I came to see the riot as a possible excuse for opening fire, and it seemed to me to be well established that riot control planning involved the use of numbers of officers on the ground, not a couple of snipers perched above the fray. Snipers are used to kill people, not control surging masses. It was also inconceivable to me that a riot could have been anticipated late that afternoon when the only activity was to be Dr. King and some of his group leaving the motel to go to dinner at Reverend Samuel Billy Kyle's house. This was before I realized the significance of the eviction of the invaders' black militant group from the motel just before the killing. The idea that this armed militant group might react violently to this insulting, unexpected rejection was not unreasonable. I provided ABC with other documentary evidence of the presence of the team in Memphis and the identity of the team's leader. Since I had given my word, it would not be made public at that time. I could not allow the material to be used in the program or even have any reference made to it. The documentary was aired on June 19th of 1997. It included the interview with the team leader, myself, and General Cobb. It did not include the interview with Jack Terrell or the corroborative information he provided to confirm the presence of the team in Memphis and its mission to kill Martin Luther King Jr. The program did, however, consider a number of other issues which pointed to a conspiracy and the involvement of the government. Soon after the program aired, Terrell left the country. He told me later that he had been threatened and had no doubt the government had somehow obtained a copy of his interview. He was furious, but offered to help me in any way he could. By the way, the actual air date of that interview, obviously, was June 19th of 1997. So there is a partial correction of the record as presented in For the Record 46 and in Dr. Pepper's 1995 book, Orders to Kill. Next, we're going to turn to a fascinating evidentiary tributary that links the assassination of Martin Luther King with that of President Kennedy. We talked about this a little bit in For the Record 46. There is more information about that in the book, The Plot That Killed Dr. King. And interestingly, there is confirmation from a woman named Madeline Brown, who had been LBJ's mistress and actually gave birth to an illegitimate son by LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson. And it confirmed something that Penn Jones wrote about in his book, Forgive My Grief, Volume 4, and that we spoke about in For the Record 579 and in 962. And that concerned a meeting at the Dallas home of Clint Murchison, the right-wing oil man and reputed financier of the American Nazi Party, the evening before JFK was killed. This was on November 21st of 1963. And among the people present at that meeting were J. Edgar Hoover and Richard Nixon, who was in Dallas, Texas when Kennedy was killed. Actually flew out about an hour and a half before he was killed, but when the FBI interviewed him in February of 1964, Nixon claimed the only time he was in Dallas in 1963 was 2 days before the assassination. An FBI agent named Don Wilson was involved in the search of a white Mustang that was believed to have belonged to James Earl Ray, and developed some information that links the mysterious Raul, again, an apparent drug, a gunrunner, I should say, who James Earl Ray said was his mysterious handler, and whose identity was eventually confirmed by William Pepper in his various investigations. Reading of Don Wilson and what he came across. In early 1997, this, by the way, from the book The Plot to Kill Dr. King. In early 1997, Don Wilson contacted the King family and me, providing us with some extraordinary new information. At first, we communicated through his son, who was a lawyer in a Chicago law firm. When we eventually did meet, it was on April 15, 1997, in the lounge at the Admiral's Club at Chicago's O'Hare Airport. Wilson recounted two incidents. He said that shortly after the assassination, he and another agent were riding in the Peachtree area of Atlanta, and they spotted a person who they were certain was the man wanted for the murder of Dr. King. The person matched the photograph being circulated on the suspect. Wilson said he and his partner were inclined to apprehend the person they had spotted and radioed the field office for permission to do so. The operator told them to hold on, went off the line for instructions, then came back on and instructed them to, quote, return to base, unquote. Surprised and disappointed, they did as they were told. To this day, Don Wilson finds it strange and unacceptable that they were not allowed to detain the suspect and yet were not given any explanation for that. What Wilson told me next was more significant. When the field office in Atlanta received a request from the Atlanta police to check out a white Mustang, which had been parked for some days at the Capitol Homes Housing Project, he went along with a senior colleague to the scene. The suspicion was that the car with Alabama license plates had been involved in the King assassination. Wilson said that when he opened the car door on the passenger's side, an envelope and some papers fell out. Instinctively, he put his foot on the papers, bent over, picked them up, and put them in his pocket. The young agent was nervous, thinking that he might have disturbed the evidence at the crime scene. Later, when he had an opportunity to examine the individual sheets of paper, he was shocked and realized that if he turned them over to his superiors, they would never see the light of day. He kept them hidden for 29 years. One piece came from a 1963 Dallas, Texas telephone directory. It was part of a page that had been torn out. The telephone numbers on that page included those of the family of H.L. Hunt, the right-wing oil billionaire, but more significantly, in handwriting at the top of the page was the name Raoul, unquote, the letter J, unquote, and the Dallas telephone number of a club in Dallas, Texas, which at the time was run by Jack Ruby, the killer of Lee Harvey Oswald. The second piece of paper contained several names. Alongside of each were sums of money. It appeared to be some sort of payoff list, and at the bottom was Raoul's name and date for payment. Wilson also said he had recovered a third piece of paper on which was written the telephone number and extension of the Atlanta FBI field office. And skipping down. The three women referred to here are Beverly Oliver, Sherry, that's C-H-A-R-I, Angel, and Madeline Brown. The first two were strippers who had worked for Jack Ruby, or women who worked for Jack Ruby. I believe they were strippers. And Madeline Brown did not work for Ruby, but was LBJ's mistress, and actually bore a child, a son, to LBJ out of wedlock. Skipping down. I met separately with Beverly Oliver, Sherry Angel, and Madeline Brown. Madeline had not worked for Ruby, but was Lyndon Johnson's mistress for years, and in fact had given birth to his only son. She also knew Jack Ruby and frequented his main club, the Carousel. When I put the spread of photographs in front of each of them on separate occasions, each one independently confirmed that she had seen Ruby with the man we had identified as Raoul. In fact, Beverly remembered Raoul giving Ruby what appeared to be a large amount of cash in what she described as a Piggly Wiggly grocery store paper bag. That was a Dallas grocery chain. And still more about Beverly Oliver and Sherry Angel and Madeline. And in particular here, we're going to note an allegation pretty much confirmed by Madeline Brown of a meeting the evening before JFK was assassinated. And at this meeting were Richard Nixon, J. Edgar Hoover, LBJ, and some other luminaries, one of them, John McCloy, chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank, later a key Warren Commission member. He was also U.S. High Commissioner of Germany in the early 1950s. George Brown of the Brown & Root Construction Company, R.L. Thornton, president of the Mercantile Bank. That was a Dallas bank that was very close to the Hunt family. And Dallas Mayor Earl Cabell, again, as noted here, the brother of General Charles Cabell, the former deputy director of the CIA, who was fired by President Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs. Again, in Forgive My Grief, Volume 4 by Penn Jones, there is discussion of this meeting, and this presents what appears to be confirmation of that meeting on November 21st at oil man Clint Murchison's home. William Pepper writes of this, I had Madeline Brown, Beverly, and Sherry lined up to travel to Memphis, but then did not call them. It was a temptation which had to be resisted. It was not easy because I believe these courageous women, Madeline Brown, for example, were very credible. Some aspects of Madeline's recollections of her life and genuine love for Lyndon Baines Johnson were compelling. In fact, as I have mentioned previously, she gave birth to his only son. I obtained a copy of Johnson's commitment through his local lawyer, Jerome Ragsdale, to provide support for Stephen, which continued even after the president's death. That she was able to provide such detail about their relationship was impressive. Of particular note, though a digression, was her recollection of the Kennedy assassination. She said she attended a social gathering at Clint Murchison's home. Ostensibly, it was an event to honor J. Edgar Hoover, who was a close friend of Murchison, H.L. Hunt, and the other Texas oil giants. The guest list included John McCloyd, chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank and later a key Warren Commission member, Richard Nixon, George Brown of the Brown & Root Construction Company, R.L. Thornton, president of the Mercantile Bank, and Dallas Mayor Earl Cabell, C-A-B-E-L-L, brother of General Charles Cabell, former deputy director of the CIA, who was fired by President Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs. Madeline told me that near the end of the party, Johnson made an appearance, and the group quickly went into Murchison's study behind closed doors. After about 20 minutes, the meeting broke up. Johnson, anxious and red-faced, came up behind her and embraced her with a quiet, grating sound and whispered in her ear a message she would never forget. Quote, "After tomorrow, those goddamn Kennedys will never embarrass me again. That's no threat. That is a promise," unquote. She was stunned, but the next day she realized what he meant. While it is true that her story has been attacked, it was corroborated by employees of Murchison's household, including the man who picked up Hoover at the airport. I decided not to take our case in this direction. That, of course, was his attempt at getting justice for James Earl Ray, and William Pepper, I believe correctly, felt that this would alienate those who were already trying to paint him and his associates as wacky conspiracy theorists. And that is a moniker and a hair shirt that I have worn for many years, and I can understand why in a court case he would not want to go there. But nonetheless, this is very important and significant from an historical standpoint. As I am recording this on April 3rd to be played on April 4th, of 2018, the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination, I have come over the years to be, well, I don't know about more interested, but I am inclined to, I guess, hold to account or perhaps blame, although that is a little bit shallow and immature in the way that I see things, the quote, good, unquote, people whose silence in many cases or acquiescence have enabled many of the horrible things that have happened in this country to take place. The last couple of segments that I am going to record for this 50th anniversary special, and they will be entered into the archives as supplemental material to Orders to Kill, deal with, quote, good people, unquote. In particular, we're going to hear about Jesse Jackson, the man who succeeded Martin Luther King or wore his mantle as a civil rights leader, and we're going to examine information in a deposition by a man named Ron Adkins. He was the son of a Dixie Mafia operator named Russell Adkins. That is distinct. The Dixie Mafia is a Southern organized crime syndicate distinct from the Mafia per se in the South, although they did work together on numerous projects and met numerous times. And it is alleged in that deposition that Jesse Jackson was not only a paid informant for the FBI, that he also received money from Dixie Mafia kingpin Russell Adkins, that in turn was given to Adkins by Clyde Tolson, who was the number three man at the FBI, and for many years J. Edgar Hoover's live-in lover. And we're going to conclude with a look at how the news media and our institutions have continued to perpetuate the official story. And I'm going to ruminate about, the nature of political reality and truth itself, and some of my own thoughts concerning the state of the Republic in the year 2018.